I think we have one more task in the sense of exposing the project, just to show all the facets, and that is the work that Germán and Christian have been doing. So I would say go ahead and go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, you're the music analysis track. And we've been doing different things, one of which was we did an analysis of the Lachenmann piece, and then many small things. And now the last few months, there was some focus on those two pieces by Jan and Angela and Beat, because that was actually one of the tasks. And some of this we want to show you now. So this is something I prepared. We've been talking about this a lot, just to show the problems of an analysis of those pieces. This is, of course, a simplification, big one. So we have a composer who also is a performer, performer who sometimes takes the role of a composer. And there's an iterative process of composing phases and then performances, and in the end there is an audience that kind of looks at the whole thing. So there are a few problems for analysis, of course. There's never a definitive form of the piece. Each one is different. Then there's lots of materials, very heterogeneous. We have patches, we have sketches, we have transcriptions of interviews and video and motion caption and everything. Also sound, of course. The authorship of this material is not always very clear. Because of this iterative process and the two performer and composer working together very closely. And then also, not everything is noted or can be seen because of this process, which, of course, also is a learning process. So some things they just do because they have practiced the piece like over and over again, and we don't know. We don't have any insight into that. So we have this, or we suggest a three-part model of analysis. Which is the first part is strategies of production. This includes concepts, systems, or technical possibilities, and then this whole processuality, which together leads to an instrumental setup. Yeah. Then there's a performance or performer perspective, which includes aesthetical intention of the performer. Then some kind of definition of movement. What does a movement do in the specific context of this instrumental setup? And then of course, the whole interaction between composer and performer, and between the system and the performer. And then in the end, we also have an audience that looks at the whole thing from the outside. There, of course, is this question of traceability. Can one understand the whole thing, how it works? Is that important? We've heard that already. And then some kind of aesthetical value, or just what comes out of the thing. So this is the three perspectives that we can take, and this is not meant that you have to do every point, but it can help to organize the material and to see what kind of methods I could use. And some of those we want to show you now, exemplary. And I start with the first point, which is, of course, if you analyze those pieces, you have to somehow explain how they work. And I want to do this now very briefly. We know some. I'm going to show some more. So this is the double vortex piece. This is an, a scheme that Jan made of his whole life electronic.
I can let you have all this material on PDF saved. Also yesterday. So
concerning the trombones, there are like three interfaces that are important. There's a sensor that measures compass and elevation of the trombone attached to the trombone itself, and then there's an audio input at the bell, a microphone, and of course an output speaker on the left side of the trombones. And now there are different ways of producing or modifying sound with this setup. The first one would be there's a ring modulator, which is activated if the trombonist goes to the left.
And to his right.
His right, yeah. So his right, your left. If he is in that area, the ring modulator is active. There also is a pitch shift area, which is above the trombonist. So if he elevates the trombone, the pitch shifting is active. And of course the whole thing comes through a speaker, which is to his left. And there is some feedback going on.
Can I add something just for your reference? The filters are very important for the feedback.
And that is you're doing?
And that's, well, they're tuned to specific sounds. And I'm regulating the volume, basically. So they play a part, an important part in the feedback.
Exactly. So then there's the whole machine learning part. We've heard about this. It is essentially triggered by those gestural primitives we already saw, which is added to the whole thing. So this is the instrumental setup, briefly. And then of course, if we describe the piece, we would like to have some kind of information regarding form, which is always difficult because the piece is always different. But there are some things that stay the same. And I have now a brief analysis of one of the versions, which is quite close to what we saw yesterday. In the beginning, there's this movement, only movement, the rotation to the right of the trombone, always. Then the rest of the piece is kind of a counterpoint between movement and sound phrases. This has been different in the first version, that it was very narrowly described. Now it evolved. First part is only air sounds, we heard it, and then the double reed is coming in. And now, important for the form is also the whole instrumental setup, because of course, if the feedback is active, this might be perceived as a different part of the piece, as when the pitch shifting is active. So this is just a transcription of that specific version. First was the feedback, then on and off, then came the ring modulator. The pitch shift wasn't really active, maybe short, but not really.
It's also very hard to play for him, going up.
Yeah.
Just for the air con. I think just physiologically it's hard to play the trombone.
So there is some kind of additive form. First we only have movement, then there's air sounds, the feedback is coming in, and then the ring modulator. And of course also the machine learning, which is first only recording. I mean, I don't know specifically when it started in this version, but I guess it was. And then in the end, there's everything together. So the machine learning also generates sound. And this seems to be triggered by this scream of Beat. Or it occurs somewhere around that moment. I don't know if this was a cue.
So the machine learning watches the movement and doesn't listen to the sound.
No, but I mean, you turn it on.
No, it comes on earlier.
Okay.
It's activated earlier, but it gets more active.
Okay.
So
there's some kind of crescendo.
Yeah, I could tell you exactly where I turn it on, because that's in the script.
Okay. Another script that somewhere around.
No, that's right here.
Yes, so we leave this at that and go to the other piece, and I'll come back to this one. So this would be some result of this first perspective, which is mainly describing. Then the second piece is a bit simpler in the setup. I don't have a scheme, but it should be understandable. There are buffers. I don't remember how many, but quite a lot of them, with preset sound samples that deliver a continuous stream of sound. And there again are sensors, three on the dancer herself. There's one on the right foot, one on the left arm, and then one on the torso, which measure acceleration. And then there is a Kinect that delivers a mapping of like a top view of the room, and then tells you where the dancer is in the room. Now, the first part of the piece is the sensors on the dancer herself. They are translated into the volume of those sound streams. Then the second part is the distance of those 6 points that are set up in the room, invisible of course, are translated into the volume of those sounds. And then there is a third part in which both are active. That's about the thing. It's much easier than the first piece. Or yesterday it was the second piece. But not less interesting. So with that, we move on to the second perspective, of which Hermann is.
Yes, I would like to make some remarks out of an interview that we had with Angela. That was the 13th of October. That was after the first intermediate showing here at the Zeta Deca. And we had some specific questions about, first we wanted as musicians to understand how a dancer works and organizes her movements, and how she takes decisions, how she hears, I think that this gave us a very strong insight in the question how the piece evolved and how the form it achieved was completed. So. Maybe the first important thing is that Angela a very clear idea of her body and the difference in functionality of the different parts of the body. So a first distinction she made, and please correct me anytime, but I'm going to make an interpretation of what she was saying, is the difference between the center of the body and the periphery. and the center of the body is defined by the torso, and the position where the torso is what defines where I am. So if I say I'm here, it's not I'm there where my hand is, but here where my the middle of my body is. So this is directly related to the idea of space, also where I am in space, or which part of the space I am taking. In opposition to the extremities, which build the periphery, and they have different functions. First, they have the possibility to show something, yeah, and they are have a stronger possibility to make rhythm visible. So, and therefore, she connects the legs, the arms and the legs, stronger to the idea of time. So time processes, pools, sequences are clearly, more clearly able to be shown by movements of the extremities. The question, what is front and which is back, is defined by the eyes. So what we see is a very clear self-perception in terms of her body. And there are other aspects about that, and this is a question of interdependency. So there are like three layers. We could say that the arms and the legs are stronger independent, so you can move them without moving the rest of the body. Whereas the arms, of course, the higher degree of independency had than the legs, of course, they have a, let's say, a double function, because you use them to change the position space, but still they belong to the periphery, and still you can move them with a certain degree of independency. The on the contrary, and that would be the lowest degree of dependency is the torus, because every slightly movement affects the rest. And then the question where we think about the sensors, and now we have this body, this self-perception of the body, which is a perfect symmetric body, so symmetric figure. And then the sensors alter this situation, because there's one sensor on the left hand, one sensor on the right leg, and the perception was to have, let's say, or that is my interpretation, to have four different, let's say, extremities now. Which makes a quite interesting situation in terms of the movements you are developing for the different parts of the body. So the sensors generates a certain asymmetry, yeah? And allow for something which is, I would like to come back at some points, is the question of polyphony. So the possibility of moving different parts of the body that have a different function simultaneously and generate, let's say, a counterpoint, a movement counterpoint. So when we see this relationship body related to space, periphery related to time, then we understand how the piece developed, because the first part is mainly, she's mainly working with aspects related to time. And the second part is more a question of space. And then the third part, and they are combining both. So we never really asked this question directly to both of you, but our assumption is that this the form of this, let's say, this formal disposition, I wouldn't say form, but more so formal layout of the piece in three parts, develops out of the self-perception of the body of Angela. And that Jan offered and developed a system that allows for a different kind of exploration. In the first part, the sensors were responding to acceleration. And these conditions, of course, the kind of movements you do. So she was trying to do, to make impulses and to make movements that bring that are readable through the sensors, especially if they are focusing on acceleration as the main parameter. So then we understand also what why the movements we see were arise. So there is, let's say, first self-perception of the body, then the position of the sensors alter this body, make it asymmetric. Angela was saying, I'm not doing movements. I am controlling the sensors, but not in the sense of an external object, but in the sense of a part of my body, of, let's say, of a sensor arm or a sensor leg. So, and then when this position of the sensors is it has, of course, a direct relation with the kind of system Jan offers in order to make this exploration, Christian shown before. For the second part of the piece, there's was a quite interesting observation by her. She said, "I'm looking. I look myself from the top. So, where we look at her from the front, so we have a different perspective." I was arguing if this always the case, or if this is, in this case, is more related to the disposition of the space, as you saw in this four zones that are overlapping, and this, if this visual disposition of the space shifts, make a shift in your own perception, so that you are looking from the top. I don't know if that's always the case in any performance you do or any kind. This is that was a question I had.
I think I have that always. It's like a topographical view of the space I'm in, whatever kind of space it is, which I orientate myself in.
Yeah.
So I have a center-based orientation, but I also have a topographical orientation. I think it's the two that are always there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that I found particularly interesting, because it's a quite difference. It makes a quite different to what we see. So the self-perception and the perception by the audience is here quite different.
Can I ask something?
Yeah, please.
Is it really that way? Because that was exactly what I experienced.
Okay.
But that's not what you feel this sort of frontal.
Let's say when I'm sitting, where I'm sitting, and I have just the possibility to look at her from the front. Of course, I can imagine, let's say, close the eyes and imagine seeing her from the top. But let's say the reality for the audience is what the perspective we get is a frontal perspective. That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think so. You know,
okay.
I think that that through the composition, the reality that we experience is actually this moving on this surface and having a disposition which is about where am I situated on this space, on this surface. I thought, and that was interesting as a counter to the two other things that came afterwards. So I think that's...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me too. I thought of it as at first as she was exploring the space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting to see that the interactions were first with the accelerometer and then with the camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It could very well have been the inverse, you know,
mm-hmm.
as also a possible structure
mm-hmm.
of the piece. Because I certainly encountered the piece.
Yeah, that way.
Like you
mm-hmm.
did,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the question is, do we always also have to, the God's eye, when we experience spatial work? That would be an interesting kind of background question. What does it take to take us into kind of a top view, away from like the first person?
Well, let's say it's a question of awareness, and I agree that you can be aware of this view, but there's also a question of what you're actually looking at. So depending on the position where you are, it happens to me also in the concert hall when I'm sitting in the organ, and I see the orchestra from the top. So I'm experiencing something completely different. So this perspective affects me, the way I hear, the way the sounds is coming specifically to the position where I'm sitting. So this is there's a, let's say, a specific spatial situation, and there's also, of course, the question of awareness. So I personally would make a difference there.
I think I really think it's a question of the composition of how the space is composed. I recently saw a Swan Lake television recording of Swan Lake, and it was interesting how that piece was how it was just taken apart by the camera, because this is not the way it's supposed to be seen. And I would say the same thing. You could take your piece apart by taking in a camera and doing stuff like this.
Yeah.
But yeah, whatever.
Okay.
I think it's about the composition of the dance in the space.
And that was the topic in the second.
Yeah.
Maybe to finish, there were two quite interest for me a quite interesting point about the first part and the third part. When she has, let's say, the possibility of work independently with arm and leg, and then points where, especially in the version we analyzed, which was the version we saw last night, of course, where she tries to make this kind of counterpoint. So at the time, different movements and generating. For me, it's interesting to see what happens with the whole body, not only with the two, let's say, active parts. And in that part, let's say, you see a different behavior and you notice a different quality in the articulation of movement because of her specific interest in generating a polyphony of independent parts of the body, which in the second part of the piece is not possible because it is more linear, about moving from one section to the other, and where she says, I was forgetting my arms, more or less. I was concentrating, let's say, on the torso and on the place where I am. So, of course, there is where we understand how different qualities in the movement are completely related first to this perceptual, let's say, conceptual frame, out of the self's perception, and then, of course, strongly connected to the kind of setup you define for the different parts of the piece. Just to make a short remark about asymmetry and to double vortex. For me, one interesting point of both pieces is that the system breaks the symmetry. Also, in the trombone piece, the fact that the loudspeaker is on his left, it breaks also the symmetry of the trombone. The trombone is also a quite symmetric instrument, apart from the fact that you have a left and a right hand doing different things, but still it is very centered in the way it appears and the way it can move. But being the loudspeaker there, generating the feedback, it made an asymmetry, generated an asymmetry that was, of course, conditioning strongly the kind of movements he was doing. He had to behave differently close to the loudspeaker and in the way that he was behaving outside the loudspeaker. So this is a decision, I think, that in a highly degree generates certain qualities of movement. And that was the question we were asking in the analysis. Okay, I think we can leave it like that. And
okay.
Back to Christian.
So this was kind of an inside perspective on questions like aesthetic intention and interaction. And the other part of this of the second perspective would be the definition of movement, which I'm going to show just because of the time, a small thing of double vortex, because definition of movement I try to achieve through in this highly interactive context, achieved through the functionality of movements or of gestures. And there is some terminology by Kadot and Bondary, I think. There's others, but this one plays a role also in the questionnaires and stuff, which is, I go through maybe too fast. There's an excitation gesture which provides the energy of the sound. Then there's a modification gesture which modifies the instrument properties or the relation between the excitation gesture and the sound. And there's important that no substantial expense of energy is transferred to the sound. And there's a selection gesture which is a choice between different parts of the instrument. So that this one doesn't have a direct acoustical consequence. Now, those three gestures work pretty well in usual instrumental setups, like violin players or trombonists alone. But in those pieces, we have some problems because the definitions of those gestures include the following statements, which are that the gestures are applied to a material object, and that there is an energy continuum between gesture and sound. And of course, that's not the case in those two pieces. Sometimes it is, but not always. So I would suggest some small adjustments of those gestures. The excitation gesture just triggers an event, which is a bit more open. Then the modification gesture modifies the acoustic event. That means it is a gesture, and therefore self-contained as a gesture, but the acoustic consequences are not self-contained, or just the modification of an event triggered by another gesture. And the selection gesture doesn't have any acoustic consequence or no direct acoustic consequence, but kind of configurates the instrumental apparatus in regards to another excitation or modification gesture. The advantage of this is that I can say it works in a mechanical or biomechanical environment, which is what Godot describes, like the lungs being the excitation gesture or one of them, then the slide of the trombone, modification gesture, and the selection gesture, for example, the putting on of the double reed mouthpiece. And now, for those pieces here, I would then suggest also an analog environment, and digital analog being one where some kind of amplification is involved, and digital being those cases in which energy is being transferred into information and then again to sound. And the interesting thing about this piece is that they are pretty close defined by modification gesture being everything that happens on the right side of the left side of the trombone between something like 45 and 135 degrees. And modification gesture in a digital environment being everything happening on the right side of the trombone and the upside. And then of course selection gesture would be any gesture that enters the area of one or the other. Digital excitation gestures then would be those gestural primitives that trigger the machine learning. And of course, there's others like that also in the dance piece. Many more. I don't have to go through everything. This would just be some suggestion on the terminological part. Now, I had prepared some kind of analysis, but I think we leave that.
So what is FBRM and PS?
That was the feedback ring modulator.
Okay.
So it's interesting that you relate that to those more traditional gesture terms. Because, I mean, we know this catalogue of, I mean, and Alexandra has worked extensively on the catalogue of gesture terminology, and we've seen some of it. And I wonder if we stripped out the left part and we look at this, and maybe not in this, how are you saying, this matrix, whether there would be more appropriate terminology for them.
Probably, yeah. I mean, this is just something I needed to do because the terminology didn't work.
Yeah. And so that's something I'm interested in, and having seen. I mean, I think a lot of the traditional musical gesture terminology is geared towards the traditional playing, and of course here we're in an extremely hybrid situation, particularly in the dance piece where everything is upside down. And my question there would be, first of all, do we use the term gesture? That would be one thing. I think it's still useful, but we have to define it carefully.
It's not visual then.
Well, this
non-visual gesture.
Is a gesture necessarily visual, or is it necessarily kinetic?
Exactly.
Because in the music psychology, there's a lot of literature on the sonic gestures of musical compositions, like melodies and phrases and arcs, and all of that is in the sound.
Yes, exactly.
It's just something I'm thinking would be really interesting to think of, coming from this perspective and leaving out the established terminology and see what kind of alternative terminology.
What would be, maybe you should ask Angela, what could be translations in dance for these elements, excitation, modification, selection? Maybe it's a bit quick to ask you, but maybe it should be interesting to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
How, I remember in the corporeal group in Antwerp, we have another dancer, Aline, and she talked about states.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of states, to being in a certain state in dance, which is rather different from what we use in music, like a modification of or movement. So I think there could be maybe an interesting approach to look at how is it, because everything is movement or excitation in dance in a certain way, you could say.
Yeah.
So I remember Aline took the name of states, but I can imagine there are probably even other possibilities to try to name these two.
I think state is comes close. It has, for me, it has a lot to do with focus, where I aim my focus at. Is it more on the energetic? Is it more on the functional?
Because the question is whether why you would want to find something similar in dance, because I guess in a way the point of those three is really to describe sound producing actions. So it's kind of the coupling,
yeah.
The relationship between motion and sound. So I guess you could use the same in dance because you're making sounds in dance as well. So then you kind of have sound producing actions there as well, although they may not be musical in the same sense as they are when they are playing an instrument. But if you're moving your foot on the floor, it's an excitation action, right? I mean, you're producing sound through the energy transfer from foot to floor.
Or the breathing sound in the dance.
Breathing
piece,
in the same way. So
the way the breathing was maybe treated, I don't know.
That was just being out.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, that goes even further. I find I use the expression that I'm listening to my movement, and that for me is totally natural. It's not a
construct of mine, but it, I am listening to my movement while I'm moving. With, I'm not listening to this, to the sound of it, but I'm listening to the inside sound that I have somehow.
Which goes maybe into the direction of kinesthetic perception and motor resonances on a physiological level. So yeah, I mean, that's certainly something that, that I will try to investigate a little more in terms of also as an outcome of the work you have been doing and the kind of the preliminary work we've... I think last year we showed kind of the mind map of gesture terminology. And I think it'd be interesting to add one layer, which is in this kind of non or hybrid context where we are now with technology and with this mixing of things, we're in a hybrid context, which somehow I think asks for a redefinition of the main terms, even if it refers back to traditional practice like instrumentalist, or even further back to just our physiologic and kinesthetic states.
I think what is you call this the old ways of giving names, but at the same time, if I see this analysis, in a certain way, you use this kind of categorization, even if it's not with these words. While if I hear Angela, I see this difficulty to go from a kind of construct, which is with numbers, with categories, to a kind of flow and focus and movement that goes in a process, and which is probably very different to say which would, and then I come a bit to Alexander, which would not be a translation of every term into dance, because then we enter again the same system. So it's a question if there would be another way to look at from another side that could mirror this, but not with this kind of schemata in this way. It's just that the question.